most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So it appears the Worm is going to be in Singapore. Yes, Dennis Rodman, who is one of the few people in the U.S. who've ever been to North Korea and have met face-to-face with the Kim Jong-un. So I guess this is our top diplomatic advisor going forward. Just kind of throwing that out there. But it appears the Hare Summit will go on. And here to share a little thoughts on that, our good friend Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
You're very welcome. Glad to be with you.
So the Hare Summit is going to actually happen. We're not pulling out of this. There's not going to be an about face. There's not going to be an angry letter or tweet or anything that's going to blow it up.
Well, I guess that's still possible, but it does appear like it is going to go ahead. I am going to be there. My preparations are all in order. The White House is still helping all of us reporters sort things out. So, yeah, it seems like things are moving ahead. We've gotten over the last 24 hours a few announcements that the sort of photo op or whatever ceremony is going to kick off the talks is scheduled for prime time next Monday at the made-for-TV foreign policy spectacle, 9 p.m. Eastern time. Who knows exactly what will kick this off? If you go back to the meeting that Kim Jong-un had with the president of South Korea last month at the demilitarized zone, there was, I don't even know what it was, some sort of honor guard, some soldiers in traditional costumes playing traditional instruments and a procession, a lot of different places for staged photos and things like that before the two men sort of retreated from the public eye and had their talks. So maybe there will be something similar, but yeah, it's a 12-hour time difference, and that means kick it off Tuesday morning in Singapore. Makes for great TV the day before.
How wonderful. And lots of pomp and circumstance, which we know Trump loves, lots of feeding the ego, which I'm sure Un loves as well. So this could just be the narcissist's dream.
It could be. I guess I am a little heartened to see that the White House does appear, and Trump in particular, because the White House thing, the White House says something these days doesn't really mean much. Trump has been talking, I think, in more measured terms about what he hopes to achieve with a first meeting. And I think you and I had discussed in sort of the past few weeks that it was sort of unrealistic to assume that one meeting could really fix everything. Right. And now the president is talking about a series of meetings. And even more substantial is that it appears, at least according to Reuters, one report from that news outlet over the past day, that maybe Trump is sort of also putting off the notion that the nuclear element of the negotiations is going to be settled from this one meeting. The talk now is maybe that what these two men are going to agree to is some sort of roadmap to officially end the Korean War, which is still in a state of armistice for more than six decades.
Right.
And that would be pretty major, because that has been sort of the reverse order of operations than the one that previous American presidents have felt. They always thought, let's put the end of the Korean War at the end because it's what North Korea sort of wants and we can give it to them, whereas we want them to do other stuff related to nuclear. So now the thinking is we do this first and it will lower tensions and it will undermine the North Korean argument that the U.S. is the aggressor, right? That, you know, we have all our troops in the Korean Peninsula, not to defend our ally, but because we still want to, I don't know, fight the Korean War again and take over North Korea. So White House now says, hey, maybe let's put that first. The previous argument was, hey, if you toss out an end of the Korean War in the beginning of the negotiations before North Korea has given up its nuclear program, it sort of opens up it plays into this argument on North Korea's part that, well, now that the war's over, you should get your troops out. Now that the war's over, you should stop your joint military drills with South Korea, which is something we want to continue. So the White House may be shaking up the order of what gets talked about. And I think that sparked concerns, including from Senate Democrats, who wrote a letter to President Trump this week saying, hey, you know, they're basically they didn't say this exactly, but they're discounting or discrediting the notion that President Trump is an effective negotiator at all. They're suspicious he's going to bargain away every bit of leverage that the U.S. and our allies possess here and just going to agree to a bunch of things that look good on paper and then leave all the substantive nuclear stuff for some other date. It's possible that could happen, and the change in the order of operations here makes it possible that's what Trump is going to do, but maybe they're rushing to judgment also, that maybe it is worth thinking whether the Korean War should end before the nuclear issues are touched.
Yeah, I thought it was over. To be honest, we haven't been lobbing bullets at each other for a while.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I agree, I find that Trump is not Mr. Art of the Deal, and I fear that his bloated ego and his high opinion of himself gets our foreign policy in a whole bunch of trouble over the once he's long gone, that we're stuck with whatever he decides he wants to give away, and that's the scary thing.
Yeah, I mean it's worth reminding ourselves that there has not been a long diplomatic process that President Trump has concluded yet, I wouldn't even put tax reform as one because it's it's essentially a one-party bill, right? It's not like some negotiation where you have to deal with a serious adversary. Trump has started all these trade initiatives and never wrapped any of them up. He's torn up the Iran deal but not stitched it together. So, we don't know, and I think there's a lot of suspicion about whether he really is capable of actually having the delicate touch to conclude a very tricky negotiation. And I think there will probably be efforts made by American officials trying to, coordinate the protocol of this summit to limit the amount of moments where Donald Trump is near the cameras, especially when he's around Kim Jong-un, so that he doesn't ad-lib his way into worsening the U.S.-Korea crisis. But again, you can never really rule out the possibility that he isn't going to, go off script and start the war all over again. So start it over or just step on some other delicate talks.
What I do think is cute, though, is that you didn't think that the Democrats were serious adversaries. I do think that's cute.
Well, he had to deal with a few Republican possible defections on things like tax reform. But there's nothing really that he's done so far domestically that mirrors the adversarial sort of management of an adversarial relationship of the sort that is going to come up in the North Korea talk.
Yeah, well, maybe somebody will kneel during the national anthem. Let's move on. The UN is criticizing us for holding children in dog crates. Is that right? How dare they?
Yeah,
tell us what we can't do with immigrant children?
Well, the international law thinks that we do need to listen to what the rest of the world thinks. There is a treaty called the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which the U.S. signed but didn't ratify, but it basically says that you can't deprive a child of his or her liberty unlawfully or arbitrarily. If you're going to detain a child...
Unless they're illegal, Luke. Yeah. They're not even human. Right. They're not even human. They're illegal.
That certainly seems to be the animus behind this very punitive no tolerance policy.
And as you can tell, it's really one of these things that I don't mean to keep cutting you off, but it's one of these things that I'm just, I literally cannot believe this is how in this day and age, after all the things we've done as a nation and all the things that we've looked back on and said, that was probably a bad idea, that we've gone ahead and done this anyway, while simultaneously looking around the world and saying that other people are screwing up. I just find it really, just really quite amazing.
You should listen to the Hugh Hewitt, Jeff Sessions interview that I think aired today, in which you have Hugh Hewitt, and this is maybe an anachronistic phrase in American politics, but sort of making the George W. Bush-style compassionate conservative argument for, hey, we got to keep families together, and certainly there's a way to process adults for illegal entry into the United States, well, at least keeping their children with them in a detention facility.
Yeah, you can blow them up altogether. I get it.
That's where we were for a long time, and it does seem like there has been no explanation given for why exactly that didn't work, other than we could be harsher on these people and be more punitive and try to dissuade them from coming. And you can't even get this administration to come around to to this argument that there isn't extreme psychological duress that a child is going to suffer perhaps for the rest of their life because of the way they're being treated. And the fact that, you know, U.S. senators can't even go into facilities to see the conditions that these people are, these children are being subjected to is really upsetting. So I think the UN has a great case to be made here.
No, I'm with you, but you wonder how many of these kids are going to turn out to be terrorists in the future. And because, look, if you took my kid and subjected my kid to that, you'd have problems. I mean, you know, at some, I'm going for somebody. And I think every parent feels that way. And the fact is that, that, you know, we've taken 1,500 kids and lost them. I mean, they're probably somewhere, but, you know, I guess they still don't know where, right?
I'm not caught up to speed on that. I don't even really want to weigh in. I feel like I've heard some good reports that suggest that was maybe blown out of proportion a little bit. But at the very least, I don't see how you can, on one hand, say that you care about the life of everybody and the value of a family, and then you are willing to, you can still deport these people if that's what your agenda is, and just keep families together in prison and then kick them out unceremoniously. It's not the policy I would advocate, but that's what we did before, and it wasn't broken. In fact, the immigration flows should have been going in a way that would have, you know, made this administration happy, but they are they want to dial up the pressure even more. And I'm glad to see the UN pointing to international law that every other country on earth abides by. The U.S. is the only country that's not a signatory or a ratifier of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, and that's, I think, a real shame.
That's because we're Americans, damn it. We're number one. We're the best.
Yeah.
We're a good, God-fearing Christian nation. All that, and then some. Let's go on. Iran, evidently they're going to start ramping up the nuke stuff soon. Is that going to happen?
Yeah. This is what they are threatening to do, is to increase the purity of uranium that they're going to enrich. This is a little technical. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on this, but you need basically 90% enriched uranium to make a nuclear weapon. The Iran nuclear deal capped Iran at 3.67%, so well short of the enrichment levels needed to produce a bomb. They're saying, hey, if the Iran deal comes apart, we're ready, and they've actually submitted this in writing to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the plan that they will use to go back to 20% uranium enrichment, which is, the numbers are a little deceiving. It is much closer to a nuclear weapon breakout than the 3.67%. And that's the level of enrichment they were doing before the Iran deal. I look at this, and I really see in Iran's threat here the beginning of an arms race between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has said if Iran at all begins to increase its enrichment, they're going to pursue nuclear weapons.
They'll just buy them from the U.S.
Right. The U.S. would be happy to provide, a moment's notice, despite decades of pursuit of nonproliferation.
So this is what's known as, is this winning? Are we winning yet? Are we tired of winning yet?
Well, look, if your stated policy is to, give the Saudis everything they want and to pursue any sort of containment strategy against Iran, no matter the regional consequences, then that's what the Trump administration would consider winning. And I see what Iran is doing here, basically saying, look, if we think there's a chance that overnight Saudi Arabia, our biggest adversary, could become a nuclear power, we're going to start, loading up, filling the car up with gas, right? Because that's a trip we're going to need to go on as well. So we've gone from, again, a state where the Iran nuclear deal was working, a month ago, to one where within weeks or months, we could see Iran and Saudi Arabia, sort of your regional equivalent of an India-Pakistan showdown, two new adversaries acquiring nuclear weapons. Again, undoing decades of efforts to halt the proliferation of nuclear weapons around the world.
Well, it's a good thing we spend more on military than any other country in the world, and then multiply that by some, because evidently we're going to need it, right? Because I look at this other tidbit you've got out here, that the U.S. is calling on NATO to ready soldiers to defend against Russia and their aggression. We're going to be fighting a war with Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Russia. Where does it end?
This, to me, seems less like an actual preparation or eagerness to fight Russia and more of just sort of an excuse to figure out what to do with the big budget that the Pentagon has now. And, hey, we've got to just sort of ramp up preparedness on all fronts right now. Yeah. And look, there is certainly a security threat posed by Russia. It's hard to, if you're a Ukraine or Georgia expert or anyone in the Baltic, it's very understandable that you're concerned about the revival of the Russian military over the last decade and their willingness to use that military force. There's always, you've got to look at both capacity and willingness to use force, and Vladimir Putin has demonstrated that willingness over and over. And so what Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, is going to present to NATO this week is a plan to have 30 land battalions, 30 air fighter squadrons, and 30 Navy ship groups ready to deploy within 30 days of being put on alert. So it's called the 30-30-30-30 plan, which is not very catchy. And that is going to, would, if it were to be adopted by NATO, a big increase in what NATO's capable of doing. There was a RAND study, I think a year and a half ago, that basically said Britain, France, and Germany can field about 10 battalions between them, but it's going to really tax them. This is asking for three times that from the NATO countries. So this would be a major upgrade in the NATO force posture. Again, I'm not really sure exactly what threat the U.S. is most worried about here and how
China,
were Russia to pour all of its resources towards invading a Baltic country, if even 30 battalions is going to stop that, I'm skeptical. But there does seem to be a U.S. push to go beyond just asking these countries to hit, you know, 2% of GDP for military spending. We're actually now saying, here's the actual troop contributions we want to see you guys putting forward.
It'll be interesting. And don't forget China and the South China Sea and all the stuff that's going on there and all the fun we're going to have there soon.
Yeah, it's a world of military threats, but also, you know, opportunities for procurement. I'm cynical on that.
There you go. Hey, it's good for the military industrial complex. Manufacturing should be ramped up in China really, really soon, and we can buy all of our armaments from the Chinese.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, look, I've read the book. There are thousands of things that our military needs that we don't produce anymore. That we have to get from the Chinese, and it's really just it's quite remarkable to me. And finally, evidently another businessman might be possibly thinking about 2020, throwing his hat in the ring, free coffee for everybody, something.
Yeah, we're talking about the former head of or executive chairman of Starbucks, who's stepping down, Howard Schultz, who, if you read his sort of retirement letter that he sent out to Starbucks staff, certainly sounds like he's talking like a politician, at least. And look, I think in a lot of good ways, he's brought sort of a political sensitivity to his, you know, corporate life that he has, you know, he pledged to hire refugees after the travel ban. He's talked about how, you know, economic growth indicators that the politicians point to are very different than the situation Americans feel, many of them left behind by this very quote unquote profitable economy we have right now. So, yep. I think he's certainly been making moves which suggest an interest in broader, you know, policies. The question is, you know, he was talked out of apparently a run for office in 2016. Is he feeling different now that another, you know, sort of celebrity CEO or business person is occupying the White House? We'll see. I think I was reading a Vox article today that rightly pointed out, look, he finds himself a little bit on the political center right now. He's very concerned about the deficit. Would this kind of platform really cut it for Democrats who are itching for something a lot more progressive, perhaps, than what Howard Schultz might be able to offer? But interestingly, we have another big name entering the fray here.
It'll be interesting. One of the things I do like about him is evidently he offers his part-time workers health insurance. That's something very, very few companies do these days. And it's, you know, it's one of those things where you just go, not a bad choice, and good on him. We'll see what comes out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me just say, this is a story I don't know if I had time to throw in, but India has said they are going to cut out disposable plastic bags by 2022, that they're going to ban them. And I think this is great news for World Environment Day. I've made the switch over to the metal straws and have been, you know, ditching plastic bags. And I think it's just great to have more and more big countries getting on board with this. It's well overdue in the U.S., where over Memorial Day, I ordered a pack of, went into a game store and got a Magic the Gathering booster pack, and they gave me a plastic bag for this one thing. And I looked at the guy and just said, like,
really
crazy. Come on now. Awareness needs to change on this issue. India, kudos to them. I don't know why we need to wait 5 years. Let's do it, or do it 4 years. Do it now. But hey, it's definitely a step in the right direction for the fastest growing economy. It's about time we get something like that here in the United States.
No, I'm right there with you. In fact, my wife has guilted the entire family off of straws entirely because of the poor turtles in their noses. At least she read something about the straws get stuck in turtles' noses or something. And we've been trying to get off the plastic bags for years. My wife has the tote bags that stores will give you, and reusable, and they're sturdy and all of that. That's the way we should have been going a long time ago. But we're usually slow.
Yeah, the speed with which the straw issue sort of shot into widespread consciousness, which is seemingly in the last few weeks. Of course, people have been probably screaming about that for years, but I feel like it's
about a year ago when
so much recently. So that's good that the change can be that quick. Now we just need to take it beyond straws and really look for other systematic problematic behavior.
There you go. Good stuff, Luke. Appreciate the time.
Thank you. Take care.
As always, our good friend Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by We The Working People. The Rick Smith Show.